And I assume that more members will be coming. Some of them might have been caught in the traffic, but we need to start. And we're going to start out with Senator Clark's proposal. And quick as we can get a quorum, then we'll be able to move on some motions. And then the bill that that I have relating to our Senate File 406 relating to the adult basic education, that one will move out and hopefully move out and pass to the Finance Committee, because as we get the testimony on that one, you'll find out that if we don't move it on, they're going to not be able to spend the money. They're assuming that they're going to get this money. And we assumed that that they were going to get this money when we passed last year's bill. So,
Mr. Chair, did the forecast also assume it?
Senator Olson, the forecast also assumed it. So it was just an inadvertent error. Mm-hmm. All right. Welcome, Senator Clark. You have Senate File 3.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I'm going to go ahead and make just a few kind of opening comments about this, and we're going to let Mr. Nauman walk us through it. We've got a few people. Well, we're not doing regular testimony today, but we do have a few people who are here to kind of help present it. And I first off want to start by thanking many of the members of the committee. We're obviously trying to work on this bipartisanly to come up with really a groundbreaking approach to early childhood education. For many years, many years, Minnesota was considered to be a leader in the country on this, and we have fallen woefully behind. Some of you heard me say this before, but Arkansas, Oklahoma, Georgia, West Virginia, among others, have really taken the lead now. And that's in part because when they started looking at their K-12 systems and they realized that they were having some gaps, and we're really pretty proud of our system, but they were having some real issues, that when they looked at where could we make the biggest difference, where could we actually set the stage, it was on early childhood and on all-day kindergarten, which we will mostly be talking about on another day. But if you want, if we're serious about closing the achievement gap, if we're serious about students being at grade level when they're in third grade, if we care about a well-prepared workforce in the next 15, 20 years when we're going to have some real huge issues with even just and the numbers of workers, we got to make sure that every student is able and ready to be working. If we care about trying to find savings in ELL, special ed, issues with classroom reduction, this is the kind of approach that makes a lot of difference. So just a few kind of overall statements, and then we'll have Mr. Nauman go. We're trying to achieve a few things here. First off is Minnesota has a long tradition of parents making decisions about the kinds of settings their young children are in. Right now, our child care assistance program that gives money to parents that are lower and moderate income to help pay for child care doesn't really have a whole lot of requirements. And frankly, today's child care really is today's preschool for a lot of families. So we're looking at how we can focus on a variety of settings to give parents good choices for quality pre-K experiences. Second, we want to go ahead and in this approach, it is groundbreaking in that it gets rid of, there's no categorical funding. This isn't a new program. It's a funding stream with criteria that targets the families and the kids that are most likely at risk. Right now, we know about half our kids aren't ready at kindergarten. That means they're not a low income. That means there's a variety of kids. So that's the next piece. And you'll see on the sheets that have been sent handed out to you that this focuses on the lower end of the income of families. And then thirdly, it seeks to go ahead and have an efficient mechanism from a funding stream standpoint. We're looking at utilizing the Department of Revenue. We are working with the Governor's Office, with the Department of Education, with the Department of Revenue to try to figure out how to make all this work. But it also maximizes current public investments, things like Head Start, school readiness, childcare, et cetera. And it also maximizes private investment in terms of partnering with the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation in terms of quality ratings. And they also are willing to evaluate whatever we might pass. So as you look at those numbers, they are big numbers. But this is the kind of investment, if we're serious about closing the achievement gap, that we believe we need to make. And I know that Mr. Nauman just walked away from the table, so I'm sorry if I threw you off.
No, Senator Clark, we were just talking. You have, and members, for your explanation, you have the bill that Senator Clark has, Senate File 3, and up in the upper right-hand corner, it's 07-0575. And then I believe you have an A1 amendment. And do we have a quorum?
Do we have?
Okay.
We don't have this. Basically.
And when we have a quorum, I'd like to.
And I believe it's your intention to move the amendment. And as quick as we get a quorum, we'll
yes.
move it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Because I believe you'll be speaking, and your people who are going to testify are going to be speaking to the amendment. And we just have a quorum, so. Senator Clark moves the A1 amendment, and I think Mr. McHenry handed that out. Members, do you have that, the A1 amendment? Okay. On Senator Clark's motion on the A1 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, amendment is before us. Senator Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nauman, would you like to go through the technical explanation?
Mr. Chairman and members, I think my purpose here is to just go through and quickly tell you what each of the subdivisions in the amendment do. Subdivision 1 is a purpose statement. I won't spend much time with that. Subdivision 2 establishes the eligibility. Essentially, a child, a claimant who has a child age 3 or 4 on August 31st would qualify for an allowance, and the base allowance is $200 for every child aged 3 and 4 on August 31st. Then based on income, and we are using a definition of income from the tax code, it's a federal adjusted gross income, additional allowances would be received. The highest is $3,800 plus the $200, so that gets you to $4,000. And then at the very top, there is no additional allowance, so it's only the $200. Mr. Chairman and members, in Subdivision 3, the Commissioner of Revenue must make some determination of who is eligible based on income tax filings from the prior year, and the Commissioner must establish a process to transfer what is called an early childhood allowance to claimants. That would be the taxpayer. In most cases, that would be the parent. In some cases, it would be a guardian. And the early childhood allowance must have the value, the monetary value of that based on income stated on the allowance. The claimant can reduce the allowance or divide it. And the purpose of that is so that the claimant can purchase a early childhood education at more than one provider. So, for example, Senator Stump's early childhood education center can receive a portion of the allowance, and Senator Clark's could receive the other portion. It's to allow some flexibility to spend the allowance in different places. And the allowance must be received by the claimant by August 15th. Of the year following the tax filing, or in the year following the tax filing. So, if you're eligible based on an April 15th tax filing, it would be the subsequent August 15th that you would receive the allowance, and it must be spent in the next 30, in the next 12 months. So, August 15th to August 15th. It's intended to correlate closely with the school year. When an eligible claimant. An eligible claimant would then take the allowance to an eligible provider, and we'll get into that in Subdivision 5, and they would then provide that allowance to the provider. The provider would then, under Paragraph B in Subdivision 4, send the allowance to the Department of Education, who must then pay the monetary value of that allowance within 30 days to the provider. Subdivision 5, again, I anticipated myself a little bit. In paragraph A, we're saying that the allowance must be used within the 12 months following the receipt of the allowance. And we use the MELF statute on line 2.26. That's what that statute is, to define the quality. And I think that there will be some conversation about that as we move forward, so I will not anticipate that. For fiscal years 2009 only, if there is if there is not a quality provider in a specific area, the Department of Education or Human Services may give a provisional quality rating for that year only. And I should hasten to mention that fiscal year 2009 is the first year that this is in effect. For fiscal, now moving on to paragraph C, for fiscal year 9 and 10, if there is no quality program available, the provider may direct the a portion of the allowance to be used to build quality. This deals with some issues that associated with where quality programs may not be available at certain portions of the state, so that the allowance can be used to do that. Subdivision 6 sets that the allowance may not be used in or counted as income for other state programs such as medical assistance, Minnesota Care, MIMFIP, or other child care assistance programs. Mr. Chairman, the original bill had a class size reduction provision in it, and a all-day K and class size reduction provision in it, and that's Section 2. There are no changes to that in this bill. Section 4 also relates to the pupil weight changes associated with providing all-day K. Section 5 is the provisional quality rating system for fiscal 9 only. There are two sections that deal with this to give the Department of Education and Human Services the authority to provide that preliminary provisional quality rating for fiscal 9 only. In Section 7, the Department of Human Services and the Department of Education are asked to work together to come back to the legislature and spend some time over the interim looking at some of the financing mechanisms that are in here. The bill has a fairly slim mechanism, but the anticipation is that there might be some additional work on to ensure that the payments to individual claimants and providers works appropriately, so we give the Department of Education and Human Services some time to make some recommendations to the legislature on January 15th of 2008. Mr. Chairman, that sums up the financing mechanism in the.
And Mr. Chair, I know that at some point in time we'll talk about all day kindergarten and some of the other things. Our intent today was to focus on the early childhood allowances. At least that's my understanding of what you wanted to do.
Mr. Nauman, on the first page, on line 1.27, just to clarify what income we're dealing with, can you explain whether this is the adjusted income or is it the gross income?
Mr. Chairman, the tax statutes are not my best forte, but we are using a federal adjusted gross income based on that statute.
If it's federally adjusted gross income, that's after you've backed out all your deductions and expenses?
Mr. Chairman, I believe so. I'd want to consult with counsel just to ensure that we've got that.
I see heads not shaking in the negative, but I always understand the federal adjusted gross income is after you've backed out your expenses.
Mr. Chair, adjusted net income is after you back out all of your expenses. Adjusted gross, there are some things that get taken out. There's some things that get added in, and that's certainly something else that can be looked at.
Could we have, whomever the expert is, could we have an explanation of that? What's in, what's out? I think that'd be.
I think that'd be a very good idea. It is before you take out a whole lot of other expenses.
Sure. And then on line on page 2, line 2.2, what is the latter part of that sentence mean? The Department of Revenue must establish a process of allowing each early childhood allowance to be divided or reduced by each claimant.
Mr. Chair, I believe Mr. Nauman talked about this, but there's a couple scenarios. I mean, it could be that my allowance is split between two providers at the same time. I think more realistically, it could be that I would be moving or my child might be a year older and I want to, during that year, maybe they've been in your fine place for part of the year, but now at the beginning of the new year, they're being in a different place. So okay. We just didn't want to make it so that once you picked a place, you didn't have any possibility of going someplace else.
And then the question that went through my head is that a number of years ago we set up under Governor Carlson a savings account for children or for anyone for educational purposes. And we spent 2 years trying to find a provider that actually would handle the accounts. And one of the things that I was thinking about here is, would the Department of Revenue or the Department of Finance be carrying an account for each child? Because let's say if they only claim part of that amount but yet are eligible for the full amount, how does the department keep track of that?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, do you want to respond to that? Or I'm happy to if you'd like me to.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Clark, it's your bill. I'm happy to deal
Go
with
ahead.
The technical aspects of this.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members, I think under that particular scenario, the way that the assumption in the drafting process was that the Department of Revenue would convey an allowance to each eligible claimant based on their income, however that is defined, and then the allowance, and that could be, and the Department of Revenue has some flexibility in the language to determine the proper manner in which that allowance could be conveyed. It could be I think some have suggested that it could be conveyed electronically or in the form of a debit card. And then that allowance would then be used to purchase services at a particular eligible provider. So I don't think it would be that I'm sure the Department of Revenue would, or some portion of state government would want to maintain a tracking record of who got what, but that is not, in fact, required in the bill.
Mr. Chair?
But wouldn't it be required in that a child would be eligible for a certain amount? How would we know if that child received that amount or if the claims came in over and above that amount?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think if you look at right now the way it's set up, it in some ways it would be similar to what we're doing with child care, although frankly a lot simpler. So I'm the provider. You've just brought your certificate or your card or whatever this thing is, and I submit a claim back to the state. I get paid within 30 days. So it's not going to be as complicated as some of the other kinds of things that we have out there. We will never go over a certain amount. They're only eligible for up to the maximum amount that their income would be. And I think that you're raising some of good technical questions that we're still trying to work out, and that's why we wanted that year, you know, that what we'd like to see is some of this get out for this fall. And it may be that we work on figuring out between pilots or entities that are already meeting the quality rating standard or something so we can get moving. But we think that a few of these things in terms of how actually the money transfers need a little bit of time to get the bugs out of them. But the goal is to make it as simple as possible for the families and, frankly, have as little bureaucracy as possible as well. So right now we're not envisioning that there would be many, many transfers between the state and providers.
You know, I'm not trying to raise undue questions. I'm just reflecting back on what we went through for 2 years, and every time, and that was when I was chairing the Higher Ed Committee, every year we'd call, the responsibility was given to the Higher Education Coordinating Board at that time, and every year we'd call them in and say, how come this program is not up and running?
Right.
Well, they sent out RFPs for providers to keep track of the accounts because each individual had an account. And I guess maybe I'm failing to understand how this works, but if a child is eligible for a certain amount of money, that does create somewhat of an account. And that there's going to be a drawdown on that account over that period of the year, unless it's a direct full payment to that child up front. But then the problem we run into is, how do we know that that money is going to be spent on a particular approved program? So the accountability, I think, is more
right.
what I'm getting at.
And I might not have
mechanism.
And Mr. Chair, I might have misunderstood your question. This doesn't transfer year to year like a scholarship. What I understand what you were trying to do before is I could have put money aside for our kids who I would have been great to have had a lot of money aside by the time they went to college, but they would have had to have been keeping track of money over time. Mm-hmm. This is gone within a year. It doesn't carry from year to year. There's nothing like that. It is more similar to what you see with, again, child care assistance. We've got a pretty good idea about how much money I would be eligible for, and I wouldn't be able to get more than that. There's a cap on that. So it we do have mechanisms currently with that. And then the original thought in the bill had been to have the funds go straight to the parents, but many of us were concerned about the same thing you were. We wanted to make sure the money got to a provider that met the quality, because otherwise what's the point? And so right now the mechanism is that the money would go directly to an approved provider. So the way we track it is we would know that the money was being used at a place that was approved.
Yeah. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Clark, I like this bill. That's the only part that I'm trying to figure out, too. Senator Clark, when you talk about it going to the provider, let's say that you have... How often would it go? Would they have to pay the provider every week, every 6 months? What can you help me with that?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Senator Wergen, under the way the bill is currently structured is if I'm the provider and this child is coming here, I go ahead and I could just send it out. It could be once. We could go ahead and do it monthly, but it's not supposed to be. It's not supposed to, again, be like what we do over in the human services side where we're creating many, many, many payments. So, again, the thought is I'm participating, if you want to use the term enrolled, in this pre-K situation. We know what the costs are. The provider has submitted it. The state will go ahead and send it back. So if we think we need to have multiple payments, we can work that out. We do not; it's not necessarily required under this.
Senator Olson.
Senator Olson. Mr. Chairman and Senator Clark, in reviewing this on the same topic, are you anticipating that the payment, a single payment to the provider, would be likely to be in advance of their actually having received the services, or is it like a payment after the fact? So if they qualify in April and receive the payment by the end of August, is it for the previous year, or is it for the year that the school year coming, or approximate school year? I don't know if by August 15th you're predicting that the Labor Day start bill is going to be eliminated, but we won't get into that right now. What time frame would that be for? Because that would dictate then the accountability, if it's in advance,
right,
would have to be with the provider, that you're assured that they are, in fact, are getting the service, which is paid
correct.
In advance for.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I mean, the goal is to make sure that we're getting the right kind of service and the money is getting to the provider and the child does actually exist in there. And Mr. Nauman, do you want to speak to the more technical aspect of that? I mean, we're still trying to, frankly, we're trying to work out a little bit of this still.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I think your question was, is the tax filing in advance of the year in which the claimant would be eligible to receive the allowance? And I think the answer to that is yes. You would file your tax returns. The taxes that we are all worried about filing right now is for 2006. And hypothetically, if this program were up and running and I had a child that was aged 3 or 4 on, or anticipated to be aged 3 or 4 on August 31st, that child would be would make me eligible to receive an allowance on his or her behalf.
Mr. Chairman, I understood the tax part that you had described, but it was the payment as to when the payment would be received in relation to it, because you've said
yes. You're
not anticipating it's going to be doled out as the service is received, that it's likely to be a bulk payment in advance.
It would be, Mr. Chair.
Or just when the service has begun.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Clark, I think perhaps one way to think about this is to separate the allowance from the payment system. The allowance is not a payment in and of itself. The allowance is something that the Department of Revenue would convey to an eligible recipient, and that eligible recipient would then take it to an eligible provider of an early childhood service, and it is at that point that when the eligible provider conveys it to the Department of Education that a payment would occur.
Okay.
So they could theoretically sit on it until July of the subsequent year and convey it at that point, and then the Department of Education would need to make the payment. I don't think that's likely. But
yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nauman, so you're saying that the parent could sit on the piece of paper, possibly even lose it. but that if you were to say that as they have engaged a provider that meets their criteria and they have, you know, they've indicated that they will be using this allowance for that, one could presume that they would give it to them and they technically could have the money in advance of delivering the service. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I don't believe so. I think what I said was that the provider, I was just trying to separate the allowance from the payment system and just indicate that an allowance would be conveyed to a claimant who would then provide that, and it could be electronic, and the Department of Revenue has some flexibility to determine out the most appropriate way to convey that to the an eligible provider who would then receive a payment for the service within 30 days after the provider provides the allowance to the Department of Education.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nauman, then the Department of Education then becomes kind of the bank to have to pay out as the services are rendered.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, although it's not an appropriation is not included in here, but my presumption would be that at a point in which we actually put together, if this were in an omnibus bill or if it were moving on its own, at the committee's pleasure, we would need to include an appropriation that was our best estimate of what we thought this bill would cost, and that would be an appropriation to the Department of Education.
Thank you.
Senator Rummel had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Clark, I too like the bill. This might be a minor technicality. On line 2.5, when we talk about people filing by April 15th, if somebody were to be transferred into this state and have an eligible child, they would not be eligible for this service.
Mr. Senator Chair, Clark. Senator Rummel, one of the things that we actually are thinking we'll get another similar minor technicality before we come back again as we start working on this within the omnibus bill is that there are some people who also, we've instructed revenue to look at people who may not file and how to deal with them, but there are people who don't have to file by April 15th because they don't have a tax obligation and they do it later, and would they then no longer be eligible? That's one of the things we start to talk to revenue about, so it would be the same kind of thing. We do need to work that out.
Extensions. Some people would get extensions.
Senator Worgan, and then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Clark, why are we prepaying instead of reimbursing the provider?
Mr. Chair and Senator Worgan, I think the intent is that you get reimbursed upon delivery of the service. What is not worked out is how frequently would that be, or would it be that I'm into October and I know that this child is enrolled for the rest of the year, that they get the payments. We're trying to work that out. That's part of why we started the discussions with the department, is to figure out, again, both from an accountability standpoint, but also an ease of payment, what that would actually look like. So we'll work with you on that.
Thank you. Senator Clark, on the daycare, you mentioned a couple times referencing the daycare. Is the daycare does the payment for daycare services go to the individual, or does it go to the provider of the daycare?
Mr. Chair, it would go to the provider.
Okay, so there would be a difference. This would go to the parent.
No, Mr. Chair, this all goes to the provider. What happens is, again, think of it as if I'm the parent, revenue would send me a something. Senator Bonhoff was suggesting maybe it looks like a, you know, a gift card or something. But whatever it is, I get something, whether it's a certificate or whatever. I get that says, here, Terrell Clark, this is what you could get for Colin. This is your it. And then I go to a place that meets the standards that we're talking about, because we want to make sure that the place meets the research-based elements, and it could be in a variety of settings. And I give it to them. But what happens then is that they then connect with whatever way we work this out with the state, whether it's electronically, that there's a code on it, or whatever it is, they then submit that to the department, and they get paid. So it's very similar to what happens right now with child care. Child care goes to the provider.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, want to support this bill and thank Senator Clark for all the hard work that she's done on this bill. And just to say a little bit about why I think this bill is so strong, we know that it's important to reach these at-risk kids, and that we, if we do anything this year, we've been saying that we want to make sure to give the kids who need it the most the best chance of success. And so by using this mechanism, we're specifically targeting the families, but we're not doing it in a heavy-handed way saying, we know what's best for you. We're saying, you know what's best for you. You know how much time your child should be in a learning experience. How, you know, you may be able to have them at home this amount of time. And so we're really tailoring it to the family can use it to the extent that they need it. And then all we're doing is saying, we don't want you to put your child in a place where they're going to be sitting in front of a TV rather than in a learning experience. And this bill makes sure that we do that by saying it has to be quality. So I know that's been said, but I just want to underscore that I think this is such an innovative way of reaching the goals that we've established, which is making sure every child, regardless of need, has the best opportunity for early learning. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I don't know if members would like, we're still waiting for Art Rolnick. We've got a couple other people who want to talk about the bill, but we also have Barb Yates from the mouth that if people have questions about what the criteria looks like or what we're trying to do with meeting those research elements that many of us have been focusing on, she's available as well.
Okay. And I'm sure there will be more questions as we go through. On the, if I just have another question on the allowance. If I understand it correctly, the allowance is made up of two parts. There's a base of $200 per child, and then everyone qualifies for that base. So if I was Glenn Taylor and had five children, they'd qualify for the allowance. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I liken it to, if you would indulge me for a second, my husband Doug and I think I've told you this before, but just to say it out loud, we do believe that our tax dollars partnering with many others buy us more than we could buy on our own. So we're willing, you know, not that we like it, we're willing to pay more money. But I can tell you every year we've taken the education deduction every year because, like, wow, look, I can pay less on this part. The thought is that we want all parents, just like we do with public schools, we want all parents to be thinking about quality opportunities for their children. And if they think that there's something there for them, that's a good thing. Now, my guess is the Glenn Taylors of the world probably wouldn't be getting anywhere near this, but there could be people like my neighbors, or the people actually who live in the neighborhood next to mine, probably not my neighbors, that may say, give this another look. You know, it's kind of like with the tax conformity bill that we just passed. From a higher ed standpoint, families up to $130,000 on the federal level would be able to get, I believe they were saying on average, about $165 tax break out of their Minnesota taxes. This would be kind of similar for those families. It would be a couple hundred dollars that we hope would be enough to make them think about the choice they're doing. But that's not our emphasis. Our emphasis is at the families that really are not going to be able to do this unless they get some assistance.
Okay. We do have some more information on that section 290.067.
Mr. Chairman, I think the benefit of being televised is that tax counsel can listen to us and come running up here and give us some feedback as we're proceeding. And I think the information that we're looking for here is what we're dealing with is an adjusted gross income. And I have the tax form in front of me. I'd be happy to make copies of this. I think it's easier if you look at that. But essentially, at the front of the at the top of the form, you calculate all your income, and then you make some adjustments based on I don't even know what some of this is. Archer MSA deduction, moving expenses, one half of self-employment tax. This is why I do K-12. It's far simpler. And then at the end, on line 37, you calculate your adjusted income. But this is before any credits come off. So that's the definition. I think I'm getting this right. Michelle's going to kill me if I get it wrong. But I think that's about what we're talking about here.
Just a quick question, Mr. Nauman. Do we deduct our Minnesota taxes before we?
Mr. Chairman, are you thinking about having another child?
Mr. Chairman, I do not. I do not see that as a deduction ahead of the calculation of adjusted gross income, but I am really playing on the wrong baseball team.
Senator Scheid.
I think it's like Schedule A. I mean, I think deductions, it'll appear with the deductions.
All right. Well, why don't we take some testimony on this, and then we can kind of figure this out. Former Senator Benson, and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're going to have Mr. Benson go first, and we're going to have Valley Barrow go second, and hopefully by then Mr. Molnick will be here.
Mr. Chairman and
welcome.
Members of the committee, my name is Dwayne Benson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. If I could have a page pass out our progress report, that would be helpful. The Early Learning Foundation was brought into being about 15 months ago. And our goals are fairly simple, and the big one is to find the most cost-effective way to prepare children at risk for kindergarten that's scalable. That's as simple as I can put what our task is. We were driven into existence largely by the Legislative Audit Report, the McKinsey Report, and some of even the findings of the legislature that basically said there's money being spent in this area and you don't know, quite frankly, what you're getting for it. And so the thought with this is, as I said in the mission statement and the vision, is to find the most cost-effective way to do that. I want to comment a little bit on Senator Clark's bill. We really have four things that we're interested in. The first one is school readiness. There are very few, if any, states that measure school readiness. Senator Clark's bill does that. It prepares children for school. What the McKinsey report and others said was you're basically measuring participation. This bill does the school readiness part, and we think very effectively. And then the second part that this bill also does is invest in children at risk. Not everybody, just children at risk. As most of you know, we have an achievement gap in the state of Minnesota that's disproportionately large in comparison to how we do generally or perceive how we do in the school experience, both college and pre-college. We think that this bill does that as well. It focuses in on the children at risk. The other thing that we think this bill does, and if Art Rolnick ever gets through the snow he will be more eloquent than I, is it empowers parents. We think that's a terribly important part and the third leg in what we want to be able to measure and encourage to happen. Let me pause for a moment and say the Early Learning Foundation is not a program. We will be in existence a total of 5 years and then we'll be gone. We will have evaluated and can make recommendations to you, to foundations, to individuals on how to do this the best way based on the science that we have. So we think this other component of the parental empowerment is going to be terribly important. Finally, we know, or we believe, and I think you would agree, that if we had an unending amount of money, we could accomplish this task fairly easily. But we think it has to be cost-effective. As I said in the opening statements, it has to be a cost-effective, a return, if you will, on that investment. And we think, again, Senator Clark's bill does that. Let me say that our activities are going to be really in three areas. Number one, we are going to establish and create a quality rating system. That's what Senator Clark referred to. Until that's in place, she has some provisions. But a quality rating system that will indicate some providers being able to do a better job for the money to prepare children for school. Secondly, we will be testing a scholarship model, largely what's in this bill, and we hope that it can coincide and work together so that we can accomplish that task together. Thirdly, we will be doing some pilots of some creative ways to provide these services. And then finally will be the evaluation stage and the reporting back to you and others. So you have in front of you our progress report. Those are the comments I would like to make as we endorse this bill generally, and we will be asked, I suspect, or have been, other bills that come through from the other body and the governor, and we will evaluate based on those criteria that I've laid out.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. One of the questions that...
Wait a minute, the folk hero's here.
Oh. We'll let him get situated there and appreciate his efforts coming through the snow. One of the things that legislation is kind of hinged on is on page 2 of the amendment. Is the quality, or page, maybe a different version, but anyway, it's the quality rating system, wherever that is. It was on page 2, 2. I think, in the other.
2.25.
Okay. The quality rating system was part of your or one of your first goals here. Can you enlighten us as to kind of where that is and when you would see that quality rating system actually coming out with black and white set of guidelines?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to have the other half of our staff attempt to answer that question, Barb Yates.
Welcome, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Barb Yates from the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. The quality rating system that you refer to is under development as we speak. I received in my email at 5 this morning the most recent draft, but I haven't read it yet. We are working with the Minnesota Resource and Referral Network, the Department of Human Services, and the Department of Education on the quality rating system and on the specific indicators. We want to make sure that those are indicators that everyone believes will accomplish what we're trying to accomplish of identifying quality programs. We can probably come back to you in a fairly short period of time with the specific indicators, if you'd like a presentation on that and where we are in development. Our intention is to allow people in our pilot areas to participate in the quality rating system this June, and we will be launching the scholarship program in St. Paul in January of 2008. So I think that we'll be able to give you some information pretty quickly while you're still in session, if you'd like, about the individual indicators. The idea is to get curriculum, assessment instruments, and to get things aligned with the K-12 curriculum.
Okay. We would like that, or I certainly would. I'd like to have that information. And I think one of the things that we do not so well, and we should be doing a better job of it, is we pass legislation and we don't know what we get for what we actually put out there. For the last 2 years or 3 years, we've been haggling over what the department is doing in terms of the QCOMP program. And, you know, I think we do this. We put something in place and then we say, okay, department, you set up the rules and regulations, and then only to come back a year or so later, find out that the interpretation that we had is totally different than the interpretation that the department has. So before we take a step down this road, I'd like to know very clearly what these criteria are. And then the second thing that I'd like to be very sure about is, how will this be impacting different parts of the state? Obviously, the whole area of child care and preschool programs vary immensely from one community to another. And I think it would be unfair to look at a set of criteria that only a segment of the state could qualify for compared to, you know, all of the whole state. So, Senator Clark.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, one of the in-between drafts of this amendment actually had criteria laid out, and then we decided maybe it was cleaner just to refer to the language of the other statute. But what we may want to do, given I think you're not alone, is we may want to actually put the actual criteria in the statute. But that's, again, something we can all work on together.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate, Senator Clark, all the work that you have done in this, but I think you have acknowledged even with this there's still some things that may may well wish to change, and I'm happy to support you in that effort. A question for Ms. Yates. As you develop this quality rating system, you know, so much of in education we have put our eggs in the basket of the inputs. We determine, you know, how many square feet and the qualifications and all of these kinds of things that haven't necessarily proven to indicate that we'll get the outcomes that we want. How are you? Can you describe a little bit greater depth how this might look, not with specifics, but how you would get past that? Because I'm assuming it's not going to all be about inputs.
Ms. Yates.
Madam Chair, Senator, no, it's not going to be all about inputs. We're trying very hard to answer those questions. The quality rating system will include child assessments. It will include, we're working to develop an assessment of progress, too, so that we can tell how much progress a specific child makes in a program. So we're talking about child assessments and program assessments so that we can get to know, basically, are kids ready for kindergarten.
So, Mr. Chairman, could you envision that somebody in a family daycare setting that may not have a professional qualification, but is capable of identifying, when you say assessments, you know, that has meaning, that has a variety of meanings to different people depending on how they, what their experience is. It may be somebody that's very capable of determining what this child is able to do and being able to provide activities. Would you, in measuring a setting, do some observation or some evaluation if a person has that kind of capability, or are you looking at paper qualifications for people that will be working with children?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we will be doing some direct observations into sites. We're working with the University of Minnesota SEED to do that in our pilot areas. There's an instrument called the Eckers that allows someone to go in and make those kinds of on-site observations. We very much do intend to include family child care in the rating system and to look at the kinds of training and supports that they would need to be able to get to the level of quality that it would allow them to perform the job we hope they'll be willing to do.
Thank you.
Senator Weger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'd also like to echo support for addressing readiness for kindergarten. Anything to do to address the achievement gap is commendable. I'm wondering how this works with the existing early childhood family education programs, which also in Statute 124D.13 and other sections talks about learning readiness, has a number of the outcomes that we've asked as well. And with the public schools being responsible accountability-wise for outcomes that are posted by the department, they have a stake in readiness, obviously, as well. And with that program in place, how will this proposal work with that, or is there the possibility to have money going through the schools where they would then designate that allocation? Because I believe there are a number of programs that might exist, but if I could get more insight on that, perhaps through the testimony.
Senator Clark.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Weger. Excellent question. We've added up using the term early childhood family education kind of generically now. It's kind of like what Kleenex or Xerox is. We have a specific program that is run mostly through the school districts called early childhood family education, which is a parent education model that is excellent. It does not meet the research-based criteria, though, for a pre-K experience because it's generally a couple hours a week, and it doesn't meet that intensity and duration requirements. For what this is, that doesn't mean that the parent involvement piece isn't critical, and Senator Bonhoff has got an excellent bill about that. I think that where it works best is you dovetail them, and many school districts are already doing that. Now, you brought up specifically the public schools. A number of our public schools around the state are already working, whether it's through their existing school readiness dollars or their own initiatives, on a pre-K education experiences that may already meet these standards, or they may tweak it. You may find a district or a specific school that'll say, hey, let's modify this. If there's these resources, we already have got excellent teachers that are working here. Let's modify this and change it. So I think we will see some growth and an expansion and the good things that are already happening. I believe that we will see some schools choosing to start offering things that they don't and building on what you're talking about. This bill does not take away any base funding from any entities. Instead, it adds on. So kind of combining your question and Senator Olson's, an example I would give would be Head Start. Head Start, actually, on assessments, while there's been, 1,800 performance standards that the feds require and have been doing a lot of work with children on a lot of developmentally appropriate activities within the last few years has really changed what they're doing in terms of pre-literacy, in terms of curricula, are doing multiple assessments during the year, have found that that's been a way that they can better monitor what's happening over the course of the year, both in their center-based as well as their home-based strategies, which gives me great hope, watching how much people were able to build on their current expertise and go to that next level. That says to me that people who are already working with kids can go to that next level. We have some accredited child care centers that right now don't do curricula-based. They would probably need to do that. But I think, you would see, again, whether you're talking about a school district that has sufficient school readiness dollars or a Head Start program, they will be able to utilize their base funding and combine that with these allowances to serve more children. So, but as far as ECFE specifically, we will want to continue to make sure that the good things they're doing are keep going, and hopefully they connect. They're working on, in many parts of the state, connecting more with child care. I think that, again, the bill that Senator Bonhoff is bringing forward will continue to try to connect that parent piece with our low-income kids.
Okay. We have Mr. Rolnick.
Yes.
Would you like to share some comments? Welcome, Dr. Rolnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Art Rolnick, and I'm the Director of Research at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. I also serve on the board of Ready for K, the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, National Commission on Brain Development that's headed by Jack Shunkoff, who's now at Harvard. But my real job is Director of Research at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. I'm the Associate Economist for the Federal Open Market Committee, but I'm not here to talk about interest rates today. I am here to been asked to talk about some of the research that we've been doing on the economics of early childhood education. I thought what I would do in my comments this morning is talk about this economic case for why we're way under-investing in early childhood education and why it has such a high public return, and just quickly mention some of the research. Then talk about our specific proposal that we have made, my co-author Rob Grunewald and I, and this is all online on the Fed's website, on how to take that research and make it practical, if you will, bring it to scale so that the results that we see in the research we could actually bring to the real world. So we'll talk about that system. And then third, I'll talk about this bill, which I think makes a major contribution in this direction. I should point out that there's an awful lot of interest in this issue around the country. Let me mention Russ Whitehurst, who is Director of Education, Early Education in particular, at the Department of Education. He works with the President's wife, Laura Bush, on this issue. They're very interested in what we're doing here in Minnesota. There's a lot of interest around the country by a number of other states that are looking at initiatives like this. And I should also mention both the Warren Buffett Foundation and the Gates Foundation has made major initiatives towards this, and they're looking at Minnesota. In particular, they're looking at the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation and how we progress. So what's the economic case? I'm a latecomer to this issue. I think people who have worked in the education field have known this for many years. The research is pretty convincing that learning does not begin at kindergarten. It begins at birth. In fact, our programs, when we talk about early childhood education, we talk prenatal to five. The research I'm referring to, there are some interventions that have offered children and families very high-quality early childhood education, compared it to a control group who didn't get these programs. These are longitudinal studies. The most famous one was begun in Michigan 40 years ago. Known as the Perry High Scope Study. There are actually four longitudinal studies like this. They all point in the same direction, that the public return on that investment is extraordinary. My co-author and I, Rob Grunewald, looked at the Perry High Scope Study and found that the rate of return, inflation-adjusted annual return, public return, is close to 16%. I'm going to argue that's a much better return than you're getting from most of the dollars that you spend on economic development. As some of you may know, most of the dollars I've argued you've spent on economic development, the public return is virtually zero, and that many states, in fact, are violating the Commerce Clause when you bid for firms across city lines and state lines. I can get you a much better public return by investing in early childhood development. It means all children or many children will be ready for school. Studies show that if they're ready for school, they're more likely to graduate high school, they're more likely to get a job, pay taxes, stay off welfare, and your crime rate goes down significantly. That's the bottom line of virtually every longitudinal study that we have. But there's another line of research which I find very powerful. It's independent of this, and this is work that Jack Shunkoff, who is now dean at Harvard Institute on Early Development, on brain research. He's the co-editor of the book From Neurons to Neighborhoods that shows that brains develop in very early ages, and their development depends on their environment. As Jack would say, the debate between nature and nurture is over. We know the environment matters. He tells me that early childhood programs that start at 3 and 4 are fine. They're great for at-risk kids, but many of the at-risk kids, it's going to be too late. What he meant by that is a child in a stressful environment Brain is actually too small by the age of three. The neurons don't connect right. So for the most at-risk families, if we start that late, three, it's too late in many cases. It's not that the brain isn't resilient. It isn't that the brain can't compensate, but it's never as efficient. So if you really want the highest return, public return, if you want to make the most impact, you start as early as you can, and I'm going to argue you start prenatal. There was a study that was done not for education reasons, but for healthcare reasons. This was done by Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati, Ohio. They started with family nurses, home visits, starting prenatal, stayed with the mom for a few months afterwards. They had a control group. And again, it's all Procter & Gamble money. They found that the parent that was in this program that got the public health nurse in their prenatal, that the infant mortality rate went down in Cincinnati by 70%. That's just on healthcare reasons. Our whole program, which is based on prenatal to five, starts with public health nurses and provides for a high-quality early ed program. So the economics, I think, are pretty clear. I think the public return is extraordinary. I think we're way under-investing in this country because we haven't thought of prenatal to five as education. I didn't 4 years ago. When asked about what's the best way to invest public money, I'd always say invest in education. But I never thought of prenatal to five as education. It is, especially for at-risk children. So, but I think there's a challenge, and how do you take that research and make it happen? There's some wonderful Head Start programs, but on average, Head Start is not getting these results, partly because they're underfunded. When we looked at the Perry High Scope study, we realized that we needed about $10,000 per year for the center-based programs. Plus, we need to start earlier. Head Start generally doesn't start earlier. We need to start, as I said, prenatal. So that's one reason we don't think the current system is working. The second reason it's not working is what we economists call a top-down approach. A lot of money has gone into financing infrastructure, buildings, and bureaucracy. So our proposal to bring this to scale and to do this effectively is to use the power of the market, and we think the research is very consistent that if you empower the parents and engage the parents, you can get these kind of results. So the proposal that we made was, again, a prenatal to five. When a child turns three, they get a scholarship called an allowance in this bill to attend a high-quality program. They can't use the allowance or the scholarship anywhere. They have to use it in a high-quality program. Our program, though, starts prenatal with public health nurses, the first in the door, as mentors, all on a voluntary basis for the family. The idea is to empower the parent. You empower the parent. What do I mean by empowering the parent? The parent chooses whether to accept the mentor. The parent chooses whether to use the scholarship. So if you think about it, we're providing low-income families, at-risk families, with tools that middle-class and upper-middle-class families have. And then the mentor and the parent chooses the best program. You asked some interesting questions here when I first came in. One size is not going to fit all. We're not going to tell the programs how to get these kids ready. We expect them to be ready. As you know, Minnesota has a school readiness test. We expect every one of our scholarship kids to be ready for school. We will pay for performance, so it's market-driven. If you're good, this won't be a problem. The parent and the mentor then chooses the program that's right for the kid. If they happen to choose a Montessori program and it works out fine, if they don't like it, they can go somewhere else. They decide where to use it. And it's up to the providers to treat the parents with respect. They're their customers. So it's market-driven and very outcome-driven. This is all going to be extremely transparent. We will know the outcomes. We will know how to evaluate this, not just by the quality rating at the beginning, but at the end. We'll know how many of these programs actually get these kids ready for school. As many of you may know, 50% of the kids in Minnesota, it's not just a Twin Cities problem. It's a statewide problem. 50% of our kids can pass a pretty basic school readiness test that tests social and cognitive skills. We think we can change those numbers. We think it's critical for the economy to change those numbers. We think the public return is very high. So that, in a nutshell, is the program we've been advocating. And Governor Jody Rell of Connecticut has announced a scholarship program for 5,000 families in Hartford, Connecticut. State of Ohio is going to do this in June. Nebraska, Montana, South and North Dakota are both looking at these programs. You have a program like this going on in Itasca County. This is Blandon Foundation doing this with 135 families. We're starting to get feedback already on this. It shouldn't surprise you the results are coming in very strong. So we think there's a way of doing this and doing it well. I'm going to argue it's not that expensive. Ultimately, where I'd like to see the state go is a permanent funding for this program. We're looking to do an endowment. We estimate that a $1.5 billion endowment would generate enough interest every year so that every at-risk kid defined at poverty and below would have this opportunity, mentor, and scholarship. We probably could get these results going 200 to 300% over poverty. I think that's where you should ultimately go. I think MELF and the bill that you're considering takes us a long way there. I think this is a big leap. I think this bill captures the essence of what we think we need to do, empowering the parents, using the market to get these kind of results. And I think you're going to find you're going to be in good company around the country with other initiatives like this. We want these in pilot form. We want to learn from this. We want to come back in a year or two and show you results, make it transparent that indeed we can get these very high rates of return and this can be done well. So I'm very enthusiastic for this kind of a bill because it takes a big step in this direction. I think you should think of it, though, as ultimately the state of Minnesota should make a permanent commitment. And one of the advantages of a permanent commitment is you will get the market responding very well. If I'm thinking of going to school into education and I know that the state of Minnesota is going to make a commitment to early ed, I'm much more likely to go into that field. I'm much more likely to start a business in early ed if I know there's that kind of demand. And just to answer some of my critics who think there isn't enough supply out there and that we have a limited number of resources, I think with this kind of a bill and with this kind of demand, there will be a supply response. I happened to speak to a man by the name of Eric Mahmood. Eric is the CEO, president of Seed Academy, one of the finest charter public schools in the black community in North Minneapolis. And I said to Eric, we're thinking of doing a pilot in Minneapolis with maybe 1,000 kids with scholarships. He's running an early ed program with about 60 kids right now. And I said to Eric, if we had 1,000 kids in Minneapolis in your neighborhood, how many of those kids can you manage in your program? And I'll give you 6 months to work it up. He didn't blink. He said all of them. He can do it. He's running a super program now. I have no doubt that there are people out there, educators out there, that given the finances, given the opportunity, you will see some amazing results. And notice, we don't want to regulate that industry other than to say the standards, we have to have certain standards, but we want innovation. We know there's going to be new ways of doing this, and so we want to make sure the market is well-funded and the entrepreneurs out there have a chance of showing this committee and showing the state that we can educate all our kids, get them ready for school, get them through high school, and get them functioning, productive citizens. So that's my research and ideas on how that should be done, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you. Any questions, Senator Scheid?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question because I've had a practical, real-life experience with a child in a preschool setting, choosing to her father chose to have her go to a Montessori school, and she was booted out in less than 30 days. She has enormous. She's certainly an at-risk kid. Post-traumatic stress syndrome, mom abuse by mom from birth on. There was never any attempt in that setting to identify what was wrong with her except she was acting out and had to leave. I mean, they wouldn't let her stay. And we went crazy trying to find a place, you know, for her and trying to get her help and get diagnosis and all of that. And it took over 3 years to get a diagnosis. Because at first they were just really willing to say, oh, it's ADHD, and, you know, and that just wasn't true. Have you thought about those issues? Because I think that at-risk kids in particular can have some pretty stressful home settings, backgrounds, that are going to cause issues in an educational setting or developmental setting. Have you thought about those pieces, and do you foresee the settings that are going to get the money from the state having the kind of support services they need to deal with kids, or are they just going to be free to boot them out as the Montessori program in Brooklyn Park was?
Mr. Chair.
Dr. Roman.
Yeah, we thought about this a lot. In fact, our whole program is focused on at-risk, in fact, the most at-risk kids. The scholarships we talk about, they're going to reflect the needs of the family. So if it's a family with an addicted mom, say, very at risk, the scholarship's going to be worth a lot more than a family with two parents that's functional. So we're going to make sure that those providers who are geared up to deal with the most at-risk kids are going to be well paid. LifeTrack is a good example here in St. Paul of an organization. It's patterned after an organization in Seattle called Child Haven. It's a therapeutic approach that works with abused and neglected children. And they have a very good track record, especially Child Haven has actually got a longitudinal study to show that. And our view of what will happen in the market is there will be some organizations that will focus on the most at risk, and they're going to gear up for that. They'll be more expensive, but the return is higher. So, yes, we've thought about that a lot. We think the market will respond. If we do a good job of managing the scholarship program, making sure the incentives are there so our providers can't cherry-pick just the good kids, the scholarships won't be as worth as much. The kids most at risk, where the highest return is, the scholarships will be worth more. There's going to be a lot of learning by doing as we get this into practice, but that is an issue. And I should point out, people have said to me, well, you know, some of these families move around a lot. Well, we know that. Scholarship and mentor goes with the family. And we're finding, and this was true in Child Haven in Seattle, that if you provide incentives for staying, for example, a bag of groceries at the end of the month, hot meals every day, that you can keep these parents in programs a lot longer than the data might suggest right now. So if you change the incentives and change the program, we think we can get this kind of participation. We think we can be very successful with the most at-risk kids. And as you build programs like that, it's going to improve the whole system.
Is Dr. Rolnick, when you look at a direct appropriation versus, let's say, a credit, how do you see? And obviously, there's a difference. You know, I mean, the direct appropriation is up front, and it's kind of a drawdown on an account. You know, whether it's in the Department of Education or Finance or where. The credit is a kind of after the fact. You know, you get your credit back. Would there be enough of a difference in the upper income areas where they could operate under a credit versus the lower incomes operating on an appropriation? In other words, instead of funding the whole thing through in a state appropriation, we would fund part of it through a credit system.
You're going to need, even though I'm from the Federal Reserve, you're going to need more of a financial expert on this to tell you on the margin which is the best way to go. Let me just emphasize, though, that the research that we've seen, the really high returns, comes from fully funding scholarships for the at-risk and the most at-risk. As you move up the income scale, you're not going to get the same returns that you're going to get at the most at-risk families. That's basically what I want to say about the overall issue. I can tell you, in my neighborhood, you don't have to fund early childhood development for my neighbors. They're very aggressive in finding high-quality programs for their kids. They know how important it is, and they know how competitive it is in the future, development of their kids. And so I find that part of the program, maybe it's important to make sure it's available for everybody. But whether it should be a tax credit or not, I think on the margin, my guess is that's not where the action, the real return is. You're asking for transparency. You're asking for outcomes. You're asking for results. You're going to find the big results by fully funding scholarships for at-risk kids.
And I appreciate that, because I think in the end, as we start putting our budgets together, we're all going to be quite squeezed in terms of available resources. And if you just took, I believe, the $50,000 and above, it adds up to about $41 million per year. So that, you know, that portion of it could end up maybe being a credit versus a direct appropriation.
Mr. Chair, I've been writing many years now about the economics of state and local government investment, and I've pushed very hard not to think necessarily about how much taxes you pay, but what you're getting for your tax money and the public nature of getting for it and investing in the higher returns. We know in this state that education is critical for the success of this state. Fortunately, for the last 40 or 50 years, this state has poured money into education. You have one of the best educated workforces in the country. And I would urge you to continue to think along those lines. Where is the best return for your public investment? I can tell you it's not subsidizing private businesses to move from one city to the other, or even from one state to the other. In fact, I think you're violating the Commerce Clause when you do that. So I'd urge you to look hard at the dollars and how you're investing them. Again, I don't think you can do a better job than putting your money into education, and the next dollars clearly should go into early ed.
Thank you. Senator Wergen, and then Senator Olson. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Dr. Rolnick and then for Senator Clark. Dr. Rolnick, you mentioned that the scholarships would be worth a lot more for the highly at-risk child. I don't see this in that bill. I understand what you're saying, but I don't see this in the bill. So I don't know if that's for you or Senator Clark, because you mentioned hot meals, groceries, and scholarships worth a lot more for at-risk kids. But where does that fit into this picture?
Again, I think this bill is...
Dr. Olenk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is a major step towards what we're talking about. Minnesota Early Learning Foundation is going to work on these parameters, and we're going to leverage what's in this bill, and we're going to be adding to it for our pilot programs. And there we will try to figure out the pricing scheme in a way, as I just suggested. But I view this bill as a major step in that direction.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So do I. I just needed to clarify that. Senator Clark, do you anticipate, and I would assume the answer is yeah, that these dollars actually end up supplanting some of the daycare assistance dollars that we do now, because this is like for daycare if they choose daycare that qualifies.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Clark.
This is one of the things we'll be working out, certainly with the Health and Human Services. I think in a way you think about it as tiered reimbursement. We've had the accreditation bonus in the child care side, but it still hasn't necessarily purchased us a whole lot. In no case would these dollars go to over what the price of the product was. So if a child care center was offering the kind of pre-K experience within that, the ceiling of what the combined state investment would be what that dollar level is. So I would anticipate that the allowance for that child would end up being lower, because it's unlikely if somebody was actually in the child care program that they would need that full amount. But there are, as you well know, there are many children whose families are not able to get assistance from our program because of its finite resources, which is why I think in the long run we want to work maybe over the interim to figure out how do we actually blend the funds to get the most return out of those dollars. But for those families who are not able to participate or receive funds, these funds would certainly help them go a long ways towards what their needs are. But yes, we want to make sure we're getting the best return on our dollars, that we be efficient. We're not going to pay somebody more than what the cost of the product is, though.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may seem to be leading it a slightly in different direction, but one of Senator Clark's early statements, as well as the whole conversation, has gotten me thinking about our early childhood family education program. You mentioned that we've fallen behind other states, and yet I think that the ECFE isn't necessarily viewed as a a comprehensive early childhood program. We are unique. We are the only state that has done it, but I think it is recognizing some elements that are being recognized here of empowering parents, and that is the strength of that program. And I'm wondering if MELF is, in fact, doing any assessment or evaluation of what is being done in terms of preparing parents to be delivering the quality preparation for entering kindergarten, which oftentimes that's one of their important roles, is being the most important and the child's first teacher. Whether that's being assessed, and also whether, in fact, the efforts that are being done here could be used to strengthen what that investment is already bringing us through early childhood family education, because the participants in that program are varied. They may not have reached down as far into the at-risk as we would have liked, but there are many people that really feel a need and are hungry for the kind of knowledge and help so that they can do the very best for their children. That's kind of a long-winded question, but I think ECFE shouldn't be overlooked as another vehicle to getting to this end, and maybe there's ways we can do it more effectively even than we are doing now.
Mr.
Chairman, Senator Olson, if you turn it to page 10 in the booklet that we handed out, and I talked earlier about one of the areas we're doing are innovative projects. You can look at number 3, the parent education model, Anoka, Hennepin, St. Cloud, and Waseca, trying to do a mix of throughout the state to be able to see just how effective we can do this, what are the good models, and what exactly do they do. So your question is?
Thanks.
Dr. Rolnick?
And let me just add, Senator Olson, ECFE it gets very high marks from the parents that attend, and we're well aware of that. If we have our program fully in place, the mentors working with the at-risk families will try to connect the at-risk parents with social services that exist, and ECFE clearly would be one. It would close a gap. We think ECFE has wonderful tools. We think parenting, the focus on the parent is critical, and we would try to connect the parents, the at-risk parents, with the ECFE program. We think there's clearly a gap there that needs to be filled. We think we have a chance of doing that if we get the mentors and the parents looking at the ECFE program.
Thank you.
Senator Clark.
Yes, I just really quickly, because they both made good comments. Again, I just think it's important that we're focusing right now on trying to make sure we've got funds for pre-kindergarten, research-based pre-kindergarten experiences, which is what this bill is about. That is in no way, shape, or form putting aside or anything else. What ECFE does is critically important, and I think that hopefully we're going to find out with the research being done through MELF is some other opportunities, and wherever possible we want to be linking these families and encouraging that critical family involvement. But I would be remiss if I don't want to pretend that that's a pre-K experience, because it is not. And I just want to make sure, Mr. Chair, before we're done, I know there's some other questions that we have. Valley Varro from the City of St. Paul also wanted to talk briefly, if that's okay.
Right, we'll take one more question. Senator Hand had his hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize to you and the committee and to our witnesses for being late. We had a meeting out in Minnetonka, and it was a bigger challenge to get here than I thought. So I hope my question isn't repetitive, and if so, I apologize. But it may have been answered earlier. The provision of the bill that provides essentially a $200 scholarship to every family with children, and then there's larger amounts in the families of higher need, which I guess could be a proxy for the more at-risk. What's the rationale to provide the $200 to every family? Why is that necessary to do that? If we're trying to focus resources on where the need is, why would we do that?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Clark?
And you're right, Senator Hand. We did talk about this a little bit earlier, but I'm more than happy to talk about it again.
Thank you.
First off, the reason why we're focusing so much on the bottom part, and truly, even if you've got a couple of kids and you're making $55,000 a year, trying to figure out how to do this is still kind of a challenge. It's not the same as with the lowest income folks. But like what we do with public school,
We want to make sure that people get a chance to get the information and are able to participate in some meaningful way. Clearly, if somebody's on the higher end of the incomes, they don't need those resources. But the example I gave earlier is in my family, we always take the education deduction. And it makes me think every time about what are the things that I can be utilizing in my family that helps further my kids. So there's partially a buy-in. There's partially, since we are in the E12 committee, we would like people to be thinking, even if they have some resources, about what's good out there. You know, I'm going to use the word child care for a second, so I apologize for that because it's not specifically our time out here. But child care for working families is the single biggest issue. Families deal with finding somebody that has the values that you have, that's going to provide the services that you want. Regardless of income, that's a really hard thing. I would argue even in the cities where there's a plethora of opportunities, it often can be a challenge, especially when you're feeling stressed out trying to juggle things. So having a little bit of buy-in or a little bit of a reason, maybe a little bit of that gift card, as it were, to be saying, hey, yeah, somebody's thinking about me here, is a good thing. But truly, the emphasis needs to be on the lower end. The research is clear on that. Now, I have to admit, in the last year or so, based on some broader research in some states, I, as a long-term low-income advocate, have begun to also really look at the research that's showing that with the kids that are at the greatest risk, perhaps in the lowest quintile, we're going to see the biggest gains. Some of the recent research is showing a whole standard deviation of movement, closing that achievement gap 6 months. For trying to find time, 6 months is a long time. But with the next three quintiles, up through the 80th percent, about a three-month gain happens. Well, that's an incredible reach for our kids. And so I think that income often is the proxy. We started having that conversation earlier for at-risk. It is not the only factor. Hopefully, as the research that's being done through MELF and others, they might give us some more discrete opportunities. But the reality is we don't know always who it is that may not be there. And my last example would be with teenagers and breakfast. I think most of us in this room would think that we want all of our kids to be having breakfast. The reality is most teenagers, regardless of income, are not necessarily doing what they ought to be in that respect. And so sometimes, even in the best hopes of our, from a parenting standpoint, we don't always get the things that we want. And so, again, as Dr. Rolnick said, this is about parent choice, giving them good options. But let's let the people who maybe are on the higher end be at least given the same information as the people on the lower end.
We have Valley Barrow.
That's correct.
Okay. Would you like to share some comments?
Sure. Thank you very much. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Valle Muovaro, and I'm the Education Policy Director in Mayor Coleman's office in St. Paul. And the role of the mayor and the city is really not to tell the schools or programs how to function, but rather to lead with a vision for how a city can help prepare children for school and for life. So our administration firmly believes that education is core to the quality of life in our great city. And because we believe this is true, we're striving to ensure that all learning opportunities that are happening in our city are quality-driven and accessible to all St. Paul residents. And you've heard the analysis this morning about the return on investment in early education opportunities and also the types of societal and economic impacts resulting from investment in early education. And all of this has been researched, and we can't dispute that research. And so in supporting that research and in embracing and really thinking about what is our role in preparing kids for school, we've partnered with the MELF Foundation, the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, to do two things. Really. One is to coordinate the piloting of a citywide quality rating system. It's happening statewide in some other neighborhoods, but we're going to take this initiative citywide, and the mayor is going to be a champion for that. And then the second piece is really to coordinate the piloting of Dr. Rolnick's model that he described earlier for you. And we think that this will really impact the lives of some of the families in St. Paul. And I'm really here just to voice and echo my support for this bill language, because I think it would really enhance the work that's going to be happening in St. Paul come January of 2008. But also to let you know that the mayor of St. Paul is dedicated to the work of early education and other education streams as well, but in particular with this one because it really does look at closing the disparity gaps between the haves and have-nots, and in particular a city like St. Paul with over 70% of students of color in the school district, over 103 home dialects being spoken, and 70% of kids being eligible for free and reduced lunch. We need to do more to be able to up the closing of the achievement gap. And so I just wanted to echo my support for this bill this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you on behalf of the mayor's office of sharing their support. We have invested as a state of Minnesota and specifically in St. Paul through Achievement Plus, I believe, and through the Wilder Foundation. Yeah, you mentioned additional pilots, but is there some results in addressing readiness that you're aware of through the earlier programs that we have funded that will help us in tailoring future initiatives?
Ms. Morrow?
Thank you for that question. You know, I think that some better people to be able to answer that question would be my colleagues and friends from the school district level. But of course, what we know is that there has been some wonderful results that have happened from models such as Achievement Plus and school readiness and Project Early Kindergarten, which is a 4-year-old project that's happening in St. Paul. With what we're trying to do with the MEL Foundation is really to address other folks who may or may not be connected to services already, and so there are certainly some learnings that are already in place and we're learning from them, but there's certainly a lot more to learn about how to reach those who are most at risk as well.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I don't know, Senator Clark, or maybe is there anything in the bill that with respect to the people or the providers who would be operating the programs, is there any restriction on those providers being affiliated with a religious institution if they're doing a preschool program that is sponsored by a church or a synagogue or other religious organization? Any prohibition in using these funds by parents to have their children attend those kinds of programs?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Clark.
Just like with our child care assistance program, no, there are not.
Okay.
Senator Shai.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly like the idea here, and I strongly support early childhood and involving parents. I think parents as teachers, although there's a formal program of that, but I mean, I think that it is, they're going to teach children regardless of what it is they're taught, you know, whatever it is the child receives. So I'm very interested in things that will engage the parents. I'm a little worried about the accountability for the funds. I am kind of inclined to think that I just ask a question, Senator Clark. Did you consider that school districts might be able to fashion, if they had the funds, they might be able to fashion what the needs of their district are? Because there are different needs, and within districts, there are different needs.
Mr. Chair and Senator Shai,
Senator,
schools are clearly a part of the solution here, but since we're talking about early childhood, we already have many other kinds of learning opportunities that are happening around our state, and it would seem, frankly, a little odd to not utilize them as well. It also would probably create a whole lot more bureaucracy. We could have set up a program that would have been run for 4-year-olds solely through the schools, but that would have been creating a new program. The idea here is to use the market with criteria that can be measured to allow a variety of opportunities. Again, building on what parents are already utilizing. This is not for full day child care or anything like that. So it means that parents are going to continue to utilize with 3- and 4-year-olds, at least if they're working, other kinds of learning experiences. My hope would be that we would see a variety of our school districts offering programs. But again, there's going to be, I think, much more accountability here than we're used to seeing. Assessments are going to be required. We're going to see outcomes. If the outcomes don't follow, there will not be the resources be going there in the future.
So I think, you know, again, we're not trying to we've got a wonderful public school system, and we want to keep that strong and intact. And again, some of those schools, if not all of them, will choose to do this. But on the early end, our state, and I can tell you, when I first started working on even child care, I kept being told, it's like, look, if we could get more money into this, I think low-income families would be quite fine with less options. And what I was told over and over by both Democrats and Republicans is our state values parent choice and early education, and they want a variety of options. So this is trying to build on our strength, but pushing up what the outcomes are for families, again, using a variety of options. And I think Dr. Rolnick might like to respond to that as well.
We, just for committee members, we do have one other bill that we need to take action on this morning. And then we also have, I just want to have Senator Torres-Ray had a question. And then I want to ask if there's anybody else that would like to testify. So, Dr. Rolnick, on just, this particular point?
In response to this, you might want to check out the Heinz Foundation pilot program that they did in Pittsburgh. They raised $50 million. It was to be a five-year program working with 7,500 families. 3.5 years into the program, they stopped it. The money was all spent. They brought in the RAND Corporation to do a critique, and I'm pretty sure that's publicly available. And basically what they went down this road of putting the money through the school system. It ended up a lot in bureaucracy, a lot in buildings. They never got to the families. They worked with 600 families instead of 7,500. And so be careful going down that road. This bill directly empowers the parent. And then the providers have to compete, and they have to produce. And that's how you get your accountability. So I'm worried, and that's one reason that we came up with a market-based approach empowering the parents. That'll develop a system. It'll be a market-based system. You'll find some very aggressive providers out there, and as I mentioned earlier, some of them focusing on the most at-risk families. I'm worried that if you go top-down, if you're starting dividing this money up in any other way, if you don't start empowering those parents with those sort of choices, you're not going to get our results.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Clark, I, as you know, I'm very supportive of this initiative and your effort to increase funding for early childhood. I am, however, a little concerned about our current infrastructure. I feel that we have a very fragmented system in place, and we have not had the political courage to deal with that issue. And I am a little concerned that we have now the Department of Education, the Department of Human Services. Now we're going to have the Department of Revenue, 87 counties, 11 reservations, Head Start, and a multiplicity of programs out there, really dealing with an issue that is very important to this state, and that's preparing our kids to enter kindergarten. And I don't know if you have thought about a recommendation or a solution, because I know you have looked into this issue for a very long time, even before you came to the Senate or to any of the witnesses that are here today, because I do feel that regardless of the support that we get here and the funding that we put in place, if we don't do something to deal with the current infrastructure, I don't think we can be successful. So I would like to hear your thoughts about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, the Department of Revenue isn't there because we want to have yet another agency involved with something. It's probably the most cost-effective way to identify families and in a secure way get the money out. Frankly, people tend to tell the truth to the Department of Revenue. I mean, there's a whole lot of good reasons to use it, but their function really is to help us in a cost-effective way identify, create less paperwork for families. From my standpoint, I can tell you from a low-income family, this would be the least amount of work anybody had to do to help their kid, which makes me really excited because I'm pained on a regular basis about what our families have to, the tortured things they have to go through to get anything for their kids. again, we have the flip side of this fragmented approach that you're talking about, and I certainly don't disagree with you, is also the quote-unquote rich tradition of a variety of options for our families. Most parts of the state, the different kinds of initiatives that help our young children and their families actually partner and work together very well. There are places they don't, but they are in communication. They attempt to be talking with each other. But what one child needs or what one family needs is going to be different from place to place. You know, if I was going to wave my wand, it might be like the child care center that was operating at the technical college in my area, still does, but they ran into some problems money-wise with this. Under this approach, they could do it again, where every child that was in the child care center actually was getting the Head Start curriculum program, but the at-risk kids were getting the services. Or what the school district program, my area, that's doing early literacy with the families, they actually, if they're not quite at 12 and a half hours a week, they're close. And under this, they're going to be able to offer more services to our immigrant families than they can right now. But those families' needs are a little different than somebody else's. So I think, you know, this is not a new program. It's a funding stream that has strings attached to it. And so hopefully on the local level, the opportunities that fit the best for both that community and for the family will be there. It's a very rural community. It may be that it is either the school or it's a family child care provider. But we have, in some ways, where one could say that we've got a quilt. And sometimes we need to maybe strengthen the quilt in places. But that's the approach that Minnesota has gone. So I think we want to continue working on that. And I think if we got people, as former Senator Szabo said, if we had fourth graders coming to advocate for fourth grade money, you never see any money for fourth graders. If we can get people starting to think about making sure we've got the resources out there and that we work together over the long run to deal with some of the issues you're talking about. This isn't the panacea for everything, but I think it's a really good step forward. Maybe that was my long-winded version, Senator Olson.
Senator Rowland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for being late. I was on the road 2.5 hours coming in from Scott County this morning. But I wanted to be here because I am very excited about this proposal, and I believe it matches up very well with the governor's proposal. And I really I see great potential in it. And, Senator Clark, I thank you for coming forward with it and for being willing to work with all of us on it, because I think it's going to be a real asset to families. And I'm glad. I know Dr. Rolnick has been talking about this for a long time, and I'm excited. This goes back at least 10 years, I'm sure, when this whole discussion started, that we actually have the opportunity to move forward with something like this now.
Senator Olson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Clark, you indicated just a bit ago that this was the focus, the proposal we've been discussing is the focus of this bill. There's a fair amount of money to be expended in another provision of the bill. Does your statement mean, given choices, this is the highest priority?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Clark.
Senator Olson, I think we're going to be talking about all-day kindergarten separately. And, you know, actually going back to something Dr. Rolnick said earlier, given what the numbers are on this piece of paper, if we were trying to do 0 to 5, you can imagine what that number would look like. And I think that in some ways we're working backwards. You know, we've got a K-12 system, and what we could do if we started with the 0, 1, and 2-year-olds and we did nothing until kindergarten, I'd be concerned about what the drop-off effect might be there in some of those at-risk families. So we're focusing on the places where we think we might be able together say, this is a really good investment. We may not be done. Dr. Rolnick will come back and tell us we're not done. I would agree with that. But I think it's also important that we're not, if our goal is to close the achievement gap and make sure that we've got the standard-based outcomes by third grade, I at least believe we don't want to create a so-called donut hole with kindergarten where some families, because they can afford to get all-day kindergarten for their kids, are able to, and some families can't, and that the achievement gap gets broader again. But I also know that we're going to talk about all-day kindergarten in another time frame. We do know the research shows that this makes a huge difference, and so I hope that we can figure out how to do both. I know that some might disagree with this comment, but I think we're probably looking at a phase-in on all-day kindergarten. But that's in part because some of your school districts don't have the room for
for it. But today we wanted to focus on where can we make the most significant start and where we know that people are not necessarily getting it. At least with kindergarten, we know we've got a partial start.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to ask a long question. I just wanted to say that I had asked Mr. Nauman to draft some language. I don't think that – well, I'm wondering what your intention is here. I'm sorry. Because if we're still going to work on this, I'm thinking that one way we may be able to afford, you know, to do something in both areas is to recognize that not every district perhaps needs to have all-day kindergarten funded by the state, or that all of a district needs it, and likewise with the early childhood in terms of who has the greatest need. So even though I like all-day kindergarten. But so
Senator Scheid, my intention is that I think we need to come back to this bill for a couple of reasons. One is I think the information that MILF is working on, I think definitely all of us would be interested in knowing exactly what those criteria are and who would be eligible and how that's going to work out there. And then the other one that we had some discussion about is the whole area of accountability in terms of the money and how it goes out and who's going to be tracking it, and is it going to be individual accounts or exactly how is that going to work? And I think that is just a matter of getting more details and more information. But obviously, I think the motion, and we do have that other bill that we'd like to take up, the motion that Senator Clark would make would probably be to lay on the table so that we can come back to it.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And real quickly, I mean, we are still trying to figure out a mechanism to, again, start this fall, so we need to work on that. And we also want to see the governor's proposal. We are working, again, with the departments, and I think it's important that we kind of look at everything as we're figuring this out as we go on. But I just want to thank everybody who's been working on this so hard so far, because a lot of energy has gone into this. But I think the reason to be laying it over is we do have some more pieces that I think we need to have a little bit more discussion on.
Okay, any other questions that members have? If not, I think we'll come back to this. And Senator Clark, do you want to make the motion to? Because I think once we get some more information and details, we can revisit this.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that we lay it on the table.
Right. Senator Clark moves that Senate File 3, as amended, be laid on the table. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. We thank you, Senator Clark and Senator Benson and Dr. Rolnick.
And please, I need a little time.
Barrow. Members, we have Senate File 406, and that's in your packet. And
I'll just go up there.
I can talk through it. So if Melcher wants to say anything.
No, that's what I was thinking.
Madam Chair and members, Senate File 406 is a, I guess I could call it a cleanup correction, but it relates to the adult basic education formula, and it actually does appropriate the money that should have been appropriated last in the last bill. And so as you look at the bill, there is an amendment, too, and maybe, Madam Chair, I probably should move the amendment. It's the A1 amendment.
All in favor of the A1 amendment, Senator Stumpf is moving. Say aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do we have the amendment?
What I'd like to do is to have...
Members, the A1 amendment is before you.
The A1 amendment basically is correcting the dollar amounts on lines 1.13. And And I think Mr. Nauman and Dr. Melcher can give you a little bit of the historical perspective of why we're doing this, what happened, and why it's so important to actually get this passed. And I would ask members if we could pass. The intent is not to put this in the omnibus education bill, but to pass this and then send it to finance so it actually can we can deal with it right away. Dr. Melcher?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. And during the 2006 session, the legislature did provide an increase in the adult basic education funding formula in statute and provided for an ongoing 3% increase in the amount of funds available. However, there was inadvertently the appropriation language that went with the 3% increase did not get into the bill in 2006. So the dollars were tracked. It was something that was costed out and included in the tracking for the session, but inadvertently that particular section of the bill did not get included. And so as a result of that, we're currently prorating the adult basic education aid at about 97%. Basically, we're short the 3% that was in the formula. As a result of the November budget forecast, we've projected what it will cost according to the statute, which does reflect the higher funding level. And the expectation would be that normally this would be included in a forecast corrections bill. The money is being carried as part of the forecast, so there isn't a cost of doing this. And normally the forecast bill would be coming out in March after the February forecast. But because of the timing here, where the year is half over and the providers, I think, are quite understandably concerned about whether they're going to have the money to pay their bills, I think there was an interest in having this move forward separately before the omnibus bill to make it clear that the money will be available to fund these programs. It's my understanding that this similar language would also be reflected in the governor's budget bill when that comes up.
Thank you, Dr. Melcher. Senator Stumpf?
Madam Chair, and I don't know if Mr. Nauman has any other comments. If not, I would ask that we would adopt this amendment or this bill as amended and re-refer it to the Finance Committee.
Mr. Nauman, any comments?
Madam Chair, no.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you.
Good. Motion carried.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, next week, we will be taking up the governor's budget. So starting with that. And then I believe we'll be meeting both Wednesday and Thursday and going through that. So we do have the budget documents, and hopefully we'll have the language by then, too.
And members, we will not be meeting tomorrow.
Did he say Wednesday and Thursday?
Next
Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday.
Is the language?
All 3 days next week.
Committee adjourned.
That's not clear. He said Wednesday, Thursday.
I think he meant.
He said